Today on the show, we discuss demon lords, ancient gods, and the mysterious mythology of the Dune series. Welcome to Lore Party, the podcast that explores the stories, characters, and universes of our favorite video games. I'm Connor.
And I'm Bruce.
And we're back at it once again. It's always a pleasure.
Yes, we are. Always a pleasure.
See you, or at least hear you again, Bruce. Welcome.
Likewise, my friend.
And we're diving deep this time. I think we always go deep, but especially deep this time.
Oh, yeah. We go nothing but deep.
Into the Doomiverse is a recent term you've come up with that I'm embracing.
Yes,
I like Doomiverse.
Yes, back into the Doomiverse. Doom universe, Doomiverse, if you will. And we go a deep dive into the Doomiverse.
That's right. We're waiting on Sony to get back to us about the Into the Doomiverse movie with some music from Post Malone and all that. Yeah, the whole nine yards. We're going to do it up really big.
Well, now it's going to be Microsoft. We got to switch that time.
Oh, you're right. Well, Microsoft owns everything here. About this now. That's true. But yeah, speaking of myths, speaking of things that might never happen, that reminds me of our topic today. Does it? A little bit, yeah. We wanted to break down some of the mythology that powers a lot of the stories in the Doom games. And the concept of story in Doom games is a little loose. They play fast and loose with their stories, but I think it's safer to say that the recent Doom games have done a lot of world building based on myths, at least.
Oh, yeah. They've been establishing so much that is, I think, going to be concrete moving forward with the franchise for probably years to come. I mean, they've got a whole new world, a whole new sect of deity-like villains. There's just so much going on, and I like where they kind of brought us, which is to say to a more elevated height, and including the new DLC, saying that there is a tier above what we've seen with Erdak and Argent Dinur, and Hell even itself is the ancient gods.
Yeah, it's very exciting to think about learning more about these ancient gods. We've gotten some references to the elemental wraiths, the ancient titans, all kinds of crazy concepts that I can't wait to get into. But what we wanted to talk about today was just kind of more specifically how the Doom games, especially the more recent ones, have really diverged from what we normally think of when it comes to mythology in popular media, specifically video games. I mean, mythology comes up in several very high-profile franchises. I mean, God of War would probably be the biggest example, but it, you know, mythology from real life cultures and real life history comes
Assassin's
through
Creed, Diablo. Yeah,
exactly. Yes. It crops up here and there, but I think Doom does something a little bit different. It bends a few rules here and there. And that's one of the many things that make the stories and the world building behind Doom so unique, I think.
Yeah. I feel like they just kind of take, you know, the bare essentials of deity mythos, and then they just run with it. I mean, yeah. Doom has never been one to follow trends. They usually just make them. And with this, they really have done that again with kind of establishing both gods and angels thing, but then turning it on its head, moving it to a completely different direction, and then just almost completely flipping it to what I would say is a way better story than what you'd find in the Bible.
Yeah, the Bible doesn't have nearly enough shotguns or chainsaws.
No.
Like, what kind
if
of
Jesus had a shotgun, I feel like there'd be a lot more seats in the pews there.
The Romans would not have been able to crucify him so easily.
My God, no. That would be so metal. They could not even do anything about it.
Everything would have gone down so much differently. So different. But It is fun to think about what, you know, what could have been with some stories, but what we did get with Doom was like a kind of a just a twist on what the normal conventions are. I think myths were the backbone of so many early human stories and the storytelling form that it's very natural for us to latch onto these stories and take them seriously. I think that's why myths have such power through the centuries and through the millennia, and why they still inspire so many stories today, including the Doom games. But what's different about the Doom games, I think there are some commonly understood conceptions about mythological stories that at least the more recent Doom games sort of steer away from and almost play with, kind of tinker with and twist around a little bit.
Yeah, I really like how just your typical hero, not much unlike Doom Guy, is, you know, fearless in the face of danger, filled with insurmountable strength, like Hercules or Perseus. It is someone who travels great distances, fights great foes, rights wrongs. But Doom Guy is, like we said, different. He is this silent protagonist. He's fighting for the greater good, but he is ultimately on a singular mission. It's not for a woman. It's not for his family. You don't really see anything other than him just going in almost methodically, like a custodian cleaning right up a terrible mess.
Right. He's like a force of nature, not like your typical leading man or mythological figure who, you know, is, you know, described in certain human terms. Doom Guy is not really described in human terms. He's more like described in terms of like a cosmic force of destruction and power. And what I'm really interested in talking about is that the rules of mythology, I mean, they're not hard and fast rules. Not every single story based on myths kind of obeys them, but there are some tenets that you rarely see either bent or broken. One of the things I've noticed in a lot of, I guess, especially video games based on mythology, is that gods or demigods or titans or demons or whatever, whatever they are that. The definitions rarely change. Characters rarely change their circumstances. That's kind of a common thread I've seen in a lot of mythological stories. Like Zeus is a god. He's an Olympian. He never changes. Kratos is a demigod. Zeus is his father. He never changes his lineage. He becomes a god later on, but only by, you know, killing and replacing another god. He still started out as a demigod. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I would have to say, like, Doom Guy is definitely one of the rare instances where you see a mortal become a fully fledged god.
Right.
I mean, that doesn't really happen a lot, and it's very much indicative of what Doom kind of presents, of this outer world, heavy metal, crazy, surreal thing where it's just this guy who's working on stationed way off from the action, just a space marine, like literally who you would see on, like, you know, Alien, the movie, just a big buff guy with a gun. And then he turns out to be this huge, giant, god-killing force. I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah, that's definitely something we see. And that's, you know, we'll get into that in more detail soon. But one other thing I've noticed is that mythological stories, even just throughout all time, really, but especially early on, they were kind of made as early moral lessons or life lessons or kind of ways to explain the unexplainable. We talked about this earlier, how, you know, you go far back enough, there are stories to just explain, you know, where the sun goes at night and why the grass grows, things like that.
I was just going to say where the grass grows. Sorry.
I'm reading your mind.
And, you know, these are ways that, you know, early humans were able to kind of personify things that both we could not explain or even comprehend, even in our own wildest imaginations and our concepts. Doom kind of goes more into power. It's not really, no one we see is like, I am the god or goddess of time or of this or that or the other. They have no dominion over a specific thing. It's just power. It is unbelievable power. And I feel like it's something that I have seen before in Greek myth way, way, way before. Like primordial gods, the Greek titans, Kronos and all the other giant titans back before humanity and even the Earth was conceived. It was just this power and dynamic of giving and taking and fighting and conflict. And it was just an endless cycle of destruction and creation. And there was nothing else there. And I kind of feel like that's where we see a lot of the Doom mythos kind of resonate with, which is just all of this power. And there's just, you know, going back and forth, heaven and hell. Argentiner is like maybe somewhat of a catalyst, but the real catalyst, of course, is Doom Guy, who kind of is coming in out of fucking nowhere and just setting up shop, and he's not backing down.
Right. It's really interesting how the Doom universe, I'm sorry, I'll correct myself, the Doomiverse does take a few cues from that concept in Greek mythology. You pointed out that there was once just utter chaos, just primordial chaos among the Titans. And Doom definitely takes, some inspiration from that. But what's interesting is how it presents its mythical hero, the Doom Guy. He's presented not really as a hero who's going to solve all the problems. He's just coming in as a monkey wrench in the operations. He just kind of gums up the works. He disrupts the...
He's like a sprinkler system in a fire, right, in your office.
Right. He's like a reaction to the primordial chaos. And it's funny how the Doomiverse kind of takes that inspiration and that direction from some established mythologies, but then just kind of veers off into a completely new direction. That's definitely what we're getting at.
Exactly. It's not like he's always been there or just like, oh, I guess I got to clean up this mess. It's just like he was just a guy. And now he's just like, I need to keep cleaning up this mess. It keeps getting worse. I'm going to keep getting stronger so I can clean up the mess.
Right. That's exactly, that takes us to kind of our first main example of how exactly does the Doomiverse, I'm obsessed with saying it.
No,
now.
Keep going. I love this.
How exactly do the Doom games change the rules of mythology? And I think you just hit on it just now. The Doom Slayer, who we know in 2016 and Eternal as this larger than life figure who does what mortals cannot do and does what gods are not willing to do. He's this alpha and omega of what is thought to be impossible. But he started out as just a regular schmuck on Mars, or on Phobos, I mean. He's just a normal guy. And we kind of come back to that concept of, in old mythology, a man is just a man. A regular human mortal being.
He may become a king, he may become, loved amongst the gods, but he will never be more than that.
Right. He might become like a champion or an important hero, but he's never going to be more than a man. He can become things that a man can become, but he doesn't become a god unless he was born as a demigod like Perseus or Hercules or Theseus. But Doom Guy, he completely changes those rules. Starting off in the original Doom games, he survived a demon invasion. When no one else did, basically. Almost no one else did. Not only did he survive, he fought his way through hell multiple times and became their boogeyman, basically. And what normal human being does that? Except Doom Guy. So he becomes this singular figure that in mythology, in most myths at least, you don't really see that happen much.
Yeah, I mean, I really like that, though, because it's... Absolutely. I feel like it's more of the times of it being kind of a self-made man who's just gonna smash through every single wall that there is possibly able to be conceived in the entirety of the universe, and he's gonna get the job done because it's not because he's special or that he was born of righteous strength and will and of the gods. He is divinely spawned from Zeus. It is because he fought hard enough,
right?
And he ripped and teared his way and then almost like earned his spot to become the Alpha Omega.
Right. He didn't just win the genetic lottery of being a byproduct of when Zeus got horny once. He actually fought and killed and strangled and butchered and brutalized his way to power. and he earned it. Like, we you hear the term a lot. Oh, that person earned what they have. We mean that in the purest sense when we talk about the Doomslayer. He really earned what he has. And this is a rare example of a human being, like we mentioned, breaking through those barriers, like you said, like you put it. He broke through, like you said, through all of the barriers that a normal mythological story might put in front of a human being. He just obliterates all of them. You see a trope, or at least you kind of notice a pattern sometimes of humanity being completely at the mercy of, you know, the demonic powers, however, whatever form they take, unless they appeal for assistance from on high. So there's kind of that mythological rule that humans can't save themselves from evil. That's kind of the angel's job or God's job. But the Slayer kind of comes along and refutes that. He sort of comes along and demonstrates that not only can a man kill demons by the truckload, he can go to where they live and terrorize them for centuries, eons, and he can gain the kind of power that allows him to challenge the gods themselves. And that's,
he may be the only exception there, because right, he just does it. There was no struggle, at least internally.
Right.
With that, he had, you know, issues having enough power to do that. And that was quickly rectified with the divinity machine. But there was such an amazing feeling that you got of just like, this guy is here and he's ready and he's going to fuck shit up for the evil guys. Like, just there is that's not the problem here. The problem is, you need to get to the other side. And how many of these things do you need to rip apart?
Right. How many demons does it take to get to the center of a Tootsie Pop is the ultimate.
Tom. We're going to find out.
If anyone's going to find out, it's the Slayer. But he just kills hard enough, fights hard enough to become like the bane of all demonkind. And you could argue that he got help from a higher power in the form of the divinity machine, like you mentioned, but to get there, he still had to survive the first Doom games. He had to survive trips through hell. It's like, at that point, it was almost a formality of giving him that power. Yeah.
Seriously. He was already there.
Pretty much.
And because of that, I mean, he is still, the origin of him is a man.
Right.
He may be of at least God status. There are mortal beings on Earth who kind of react to him in a very, you know, mythical way. I don't know if there's like a church of the Doomslayer.
There should be.
There is definitely.
There really, really should be. I'll start it myself.
There should be. Yeah, all right. I'll join you with that.
we're founding it right now. That's what's happening.
All right, we're going to take a quick break here, but stick around. We'll be right back.
Hey, Lore Party listeners. My name's Abu, and I'm a producer here on the network. I wanted to take a minute to tell you about Wind's Howling, our podcast all about the Witcher TV show on Netflix. I don't know about you, but I love listening to podcasts about my favorite TV shows. It's great to listen to other people who are just as excited about a show as I am. These podcasts give me new perspective and a greater appreciation for the show I already enjoy. So that's where Wind's Howling comes in. My co-host Brett and I love The Witcher, and we want Wind's Howling to be your companion podcast to the Netflix show. We'll be diving deep into every single episode of the TV show and exploring the larger context of the story from the games and novels. And don't worry, the podcast is accessible to both longtime Witcher fans and newcomers. You can find Wind's Howling on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and everything in between. If you want to learn more, visit loreparty.com. I hope to see you on the path.
There is another person that I think sort of exemplifies some concept of the Doomiverse, turning some mythological conceptions on their, you know, turning them around a little bit. Samuel Hayden is a character who's shrouded in a lot of mystery. I mean, there's a lot we do know about him, but there's also a ton we don't know about him. And there is a sort of tenuous connection between Samuel Hayden, the character that we, you know, interact with in Doom 2016 and Doom Eternal, and a figure referred to in the Codex by the name of Samur Maker. And it's really funny how Samuel Hayden's really one of the only other main characters in these games that we see, interact with, and hear from on a regular basis. So he actually is a backbone of a lot of the things that happen in these games. But there's there are some clues that we can pick up that suggest that Samuel Hayden, an otherwise human scientist who, I mean, he's a cyborg when we meet him. There are clues that suggest he was once a member of the Maker race, the angelic, advanced, kind of benevolent, well, not entirely benevolent.
I wouldn't go that far. I wouldn't go that far.
They like to think
they are. Sorry about that. No.
They like to think they are, at least. But there are clues that Samuel Hayden was a Maker once. And it's kind of, you know, we're going to try and parse that out a little bit.
Yeah. So as we see in like a flashback way into Doom Eternal, we see who we believe, who sounds like Samuel Hayden and AKA Samur Maker, kind of hook Doomslayer up to the Divinity Machine and very deliberately gives him this, you know, unbelievable power that turns Doom Guy into Doomslayer.
Right.
And it seems that it's very forbidden for this to be given to mortals or people who are, you know, not of the Maker race. And he's really the reason any of this is happening when you really think about it. First of all, he sets that into motion. Then we see a little bit further on, he's beaten the crap out of devils and demons alike until the demons kind of force him and trap him into a sarcophagus. And, oh, this new guy on the new Earth, Samuel Hayden, just comes around, starts rooting around in hell portals, and then is able to bring this thing back because he's the only one who can be able to pass through the portals on Mars to hell and brings back the sarcophagus.
So it gets kind of suspicious how much Samuel Hayden knows. Like he knows a very strange amount of information about hell and Erdak, almost as if he's been there before. It's pretty kind of sus, not going to lie.
Yeah.
So it's not entirely clear. Like Doom Eternal doesn't completely spoon feed it to us how exactly Samur Maker, AKA the Seraphim, as he's also referred to, and Samuel Hayden are connected. It's pretty heavily implied that they are the same person, but we don't know a whole lot about what happened in between, like how the Seraphim maybe gave up his immortality, became a human, how that human form caught a disease of some kind and Samuel Hayden gave himself the cyborg body, how that cyborg body is built with Maker technology. That's not entirely clear. There are a lot of blind spots, but it does tell us that at some point there was a transition from Samur Maker, the immortal advanced alien being, and Samuel Hayden, the otherwise sort of human being.
And I wonder if when he did kind of revert back to a mortal, he lost that kind of connection to his former self.
That's
did
very
he
possible.
Have memories of being Seraphim, or was that all kind of lost? Because the way that Samuel Hayden kind of talks to the Doomslayer, it is very much as if he is a real person.
Right.
I don't know. Like I feel like I'd like to believe that.
There are gaps to fill in, but it's definitely possible that somewhere in the transition, somewhere in the missing periods of time we don't know about, Samuel Hayden lost some of his memories from when he was a Maker. But the fact remains, that's kind of an inversion of roles that you don't see in a lot of other myths. I mean,
oh yeah,
it does happen sometimes. I for example, in Diablo, the angel Tyriel, the Archangel of Justice, he deliberately becomes immortal. So it's not unheard of. But like we established earlier, in a lot of cases, in a lot of established mythologies, gods are gods. They don't become mortal. They can take a mortal form. They can take on the form of a human mortal, but they are still gods. So it's interesting how Doom shows us that a Maker can just make its, if you pardon the pun, make itself into something else, like a human being who eventually has to make himself into a cyborg. It's hard to follow.
Now, I've also noticed here, because they have been a little bit diametrically opposed. Doomslayer and Seraphim look like they have just completely opposite paths, where Doomslayer is a mortal who becomes a god, and Seraphim is a god who becomes immortal, and then I guess back to a god. But I mean, it's still kind of, as Doomslayer is going up, he's going down, and it feels like he kind of set that in motion himself.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's almost like they're just inversions of each other. It's, you know what? I mean, we're getting into speculation territory right now here, but you made me think of something. What if when Samurmaker meets Doom Guy, maybe he gets the idea, like, hey, this is a human being who is becoming godlike. I can engineer certain events to happen on Earth if I take on the form of a human scientist. He's giving me an idea. It's almost like I'll just do the opposite of what the Slayer's doing. It's...
Wow.
I'm not trying to blow anybody's mind right now, or maybe I am, but it's
like, you blew mine. It's my God.
There's, like we said, there's a lot of directions that speculation can take on this. Just again, hopefully the DLC maybe sheds some more light, but
I don't know. Maybe this was just a long con and he was just like, maybe I can just put this, all this power into this sap who's gonna just do all the work for me. I don't have to lift a finger.
That would be a very Hayden move. That's definitely something he would do. But yeah, that's all to say that, you know, bringing this back home, it's, you know, this idea of a godlike being becoming a human and then becoming a cyborg is definitely a fresh take on what we normally think of when we experience mythology-inspired media and fiction. So another example of a kind of a cool twist that the Doomiverse takes. So moving on to sort of our last example of how the Doom mythos sort of plays with and teases and branches off from established mythological rules, I think we got to talk about the Icon of Sin.
I really like the Icon of Sin.
Do you? That's kind of weird, man.
For what it... What?
Really?
No. I mean,
please
look,
explain.
He volunteers on the weekends. It's very, like, he doesn't like to show it.
Dude, I saw the Icon of Sin building some Habitat for Humanity houses. What a guy. I never would have expected. It's so cool.
Yeah. He just kind of, like, keeps it to himself. The Icon of Sin, of course, is a very terrible entity, but I like how it was written more so in Doom Eternal. I know that it's, like, a recurring villain, but I think the origins of the Icon of Sin are probably the most myths that we can ever be able to extrapolate from this franchise.
Right. Yeah, it's funny how, you know, you mentioned it's a recurring villain. It's funny how in Doom 2, the Icon of Sin was like the final boss, but there wasn't...
Just a JPEG, a bathroom.
Basically just a a giant goat head portrait on the wall that spit fire at you. There wasn't a whole lot of exploration to what it was and where it came from. It was basically just a big bat. It was a big bat. It was a giant demon. But when it was brought back or sort of reimagined in Doom Eternal, it was a completely different take on what you would normally think of as a giant demon. In old legends and old myths, there's this pattern of monstrous demons, you know, titans. They're usually not created. They're usually just a, you know, like a creature born out of hell or some sort of mishap of nature. They just kind of exist with little explanation. But the Icon of Sin in Doom Eternal really inverts this trope by being sort of an unholy fusion of demonic flesh and maker technology.
Yeah, so let me try and get this straight.
Sure.
The Icon of Sin is the heart of one of Argent Dener's Night Sentinel's sons.
Yes.
Whom the Night Sentinel in question wanted back from the demons who promised his son's soul back to him if he were to betray his fellow knights and the Doomslayer, which he did, and trapped them all in hell. But they did not give the son back to him unscathed. And what was it? They have his heart and have that to create a bigger bad through who is now called the Betrayer's son's heart, which is then taken from hell and is in the possession of the con maker in Erdak, where then they make this ritual around it. And the betrayer gave the Doomslayer this dagger of blue,
yeah,
which he stabbed the heart and then had the icon of sin sprout from that, which was uncontrollable for any entity, including the con maker, to keep under their command and wreaked havoc upon the earth.
Yeah, you basically got it.
Is that right?
Pretty much.
That's long and short of it. Yeah. That sounds like something you would just fucking make up in a textbook of Norse mythology or something.
It sounds to me like an acid
also,
trip. Like, that's not like any myth.
It also sounds like an acid trip. It's like this cyberpunk acid trip, surreal explanation, which is also like, as I was trying to explain this to you, I felt like I was trying to explain a dream to someone.
You really were. That's exactly what.
But that's what happened.
Yeah, no, that's basically it. The demons went back on a deal. Shocker. Who knew? And they did not return a sentinel's son back to him. Instead, they turned him into the icon of sin, basically.
And I like that the heart is not the sun. The icon of sin is technically not the sun. It's just the heart.
It's powered by the tortured soul of the betrayer's son.
Right.
As far as I understand it.
Yes.
So when the slayer releases the soul from the icon's heart, it's no longer in control. Like the makers were going to control it with the heart, but the slayer destroyed the heart, so that wasn't impossible anymore. All that to say that, I think that boils down to the icon of sin is not just another generic giant monster. There's so much that goes into its conception and its place in the story. I mean, it's completely unheard of. It's crazy. It's like, I guess there are shades.
Something from heavy metal.
It really is. It absolutely is. I guess there are shades of it where it kind of calls back to maybe the story of the Minotaur. It's kind of like that child that was born looking like a bull. And so the king was like, that's not my child. Go hide it in the labyrinth kind of thing. It's funny. Like, we come back to these ideas that the Doomiverse does pull some inspiration from some established myths, but.
And then it just takes it and then just pumps it full of acid.
And then punts it over the field goal where it lands on a pile of nitroglycerin and blows up. And it's.
As some guy in the background is playing like just nasty guitar groups.
Yeah, Mick Gordon is in the stands just blasting everyone's faces off with some djent riffs. Yeah. No, that's basically it.
I go to that church for sure.
We're opening that church this Sunday. We're doing this, but it's bring it all back. It's all powerful demons are not necessarily new to mythology. There have definitely been powerful evil creatures before, but I think we've established, the icon of sin is a really big twist on that formula, and it's corrupting a mortal soul, trapping it in a techno-demon hybrid shell that the combination of which is capable of undoing all of creation simply by existing. And that's just wild. That's out there in the left field. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, I haven't read any ancient texts like that before.
Yeah, I've never read a Bible like that. That's crazy.
I really like the entire mythos of the Doomiverse because it is just so out there and crazy and just literally just conceptually off the rails from the start, from beginning to end.
For sure.
I think it has a lot of base inspiration and content, and that always needs to be there. It's why we know, Eastern and Western stories and mythos, like, we understand that. If it didn't have a cohesive start point there, we would never even think that it would make sense. But what they do is then as long as you have that anchor point, you can go anywhere you want. And they do. And they just go so many different places, make such interesting characters that are never static. They are constantly changing and forming. Their entire mythos is fluid. There's different timelines. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what I believe is like a very 21st century, very modern mythos that we see here.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put it, is that some of the more mainstream mythologies that almost everyone on some level is aware of, Doom sort of takes that as a framing device. I think that's well put, that a lot of the stuff wouldn't really add up. It wouldn't compute in our minds at all unless we had some of that as a basis. But then it just kind of builds off of that and defies gravity from there. It just kind of breaks all the rules from there. It's a really interesting way of combining the old and the new and doing a completely different thing in the process.
Well, that about wraps it up. We hope you enjoyed this episode. And if you did, please take a second to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It really helps us grow the show. And be sure to connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at lore_party. And check out our YouTube page for fun bonus videos and highlights. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.